Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hila Follett, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and I'll be hosting tonight's program. My guest this evening is Randall Dale Adams, who served 3.5 years on death row in Texas, and we're going to be discussing the death penalty. Glad to have you with us, Randall.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do, some of the listeners may be familiar with the details of your case, I suspect, though, many are not, is to at least begin by telling them how you got yourself in the pickle, so to speak, in Texas. So I understand that you were traveling from Ohio, where you lived, and were on your way to California, and ended up stopping in Dallas. And
yes.
There the story begins.
Yes, being from Columbus, due to health reasons, I and my brother left the Columbus area going to warmer climates, and originally started out leaving to go to the San Diego area of California. We drove nonstop from Columbus and ended up in the Dallas area, got a motel. The next morning, got up, packed the car up, planning on leaving. While having breakfast and looking through the paper, it just so happens that I found a job. So having been in Dallas less than a day, I was working. It was Thanksgiving weekend of 1976, and on the way home from work on a Saturday, I ran out of gas, walked to a gas station, and was unable to get my car started. A person at the gas station offered assistance to me and helped me get my car started, and while doing that, told me he was looking for a job, so I got in his car and we drove back to the job site to get him a job if anyone was still at the work site. No one was there, so of course at that point he didn't get the job. A month after this meeting, having never seen this man again, I was at work. My boss called me over to where he was standing, to his office, and there was two gentlemen in suits standing there. And as I walked up, one of them asked me if my name was Randall Dale Adams. I told him yes. They showed me a picture, and this picture was the person that helped me get my car started. Asked me if I'd ever seen him before. I said yes, about a month ago. At that point, I was arrested, taken downtown to the Dallas criminal courts system, was charged with the killing of a Dallas police officer Thanksgiving weekend, and ultimately was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for the killing of a Dallas police officer.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about, you said you were taken to the Dallas police station. There's a movie, in fact, mentioned this for the listeners too, made about your case. The movie was called The Thin Blue Line. And in the movie, there's some discussion about your interrogation at Dallas, and perhaps that would be if
yes. I was arrested sometime around 9 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, December 21st of 1976. Police department, the district attorney's office, and the interrogators that interrogated me have made the statements that the interrogation lasted around 6 hours. My attorney and myself have made the statement that the interrogations had to have lasted at least 2 to 3 days. The district attorney's office offered two bits of information. Both of them had the same time limit on it, and it doesn't make sense. Their 6-hour version of how long they interrogated me, but it was a very long time.
Okay. And during the time, you kept insisting that you didn't know anything about the murder.
Yes.
But they proceeded anyway.
Well, if, and hopefully nobody out there has ever been interrogated, but when you are being interrogated, you go over a sequence of events over and over and over and over, and then backwards and sideways. And, you know, again, the people in the Dallas criminal system, Gus Rose being one, is one of the top interrogators in the country. You know, he's very good at what he does. He's, you know, that's what he does for a living. So it's not a nice, comfortable position to be into. But yes, you are correct. I kept maintaining my innocence, and that, you know, at the beginning of the interrogation, I thought that I can straighten this out. We're rational human beings. We can sit down and discuss this, and they will see that I'm telling them what happened that day. Again, towards the end of the interrogation, I began to realize I got a problem here, a bad one, because they didn't want to listen to what I had to say. And for the people out there who've seen the film, The Thin Blue Line, Gus Rose makes the statement that, we knew what was happening, so we didn't care what Adams was saying. At that point, they had their own version of what went down.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about the trial, too, because I think that reveals a great deal about what went on.
When, in 1977, when the trial was actually going on, at that time it was the longest trial in Texas history, at that time. My family and my attorney, argued, and of course the state put on their evidence and everything, and at what we considered or thought to be the last day of trial, every newspaper, radio, TV in the Dallas area was saying, Adams didn't do this. It had to be the gentleman who helped me get my car started, a man by the name of David Harris, who actually did do the killing and has admitted since then. But what we thought would be the last day of trial, all the media in Dallas was saying, it's not me, it's David Harris. The district attorney at that point put the court in delay for about an hour, and brought in what they claimed to be, quote, three eyewitnesses that just happened to come forward. The district attorney wanted the people of Dallas to believe these people just tripped up the courthouse steps. They brought them in, put them on the witness stand, all three of them, two men and a woman, stated that they had passed the scene of the crime that night and saw me there. We knew they were lying, but at that point we couldn't prove it because they were a surprise to us. I was ultimately convicted on their testimony, and within 2 days after the end of my trial, we could prove that these people were lying. We had witnesses to come in to prove that they were lying, but I'd been convicted, and at that point, it didn't be no good.
Well, actually, it's also intriguing that they testified, I believe you said, on a Friday.
On a Friday.
And on a Monday, when your attorneys would have normally had the opportunity to cross-examine them, they weren't there.
Yes, on Monday morning, court began at about 9 o'clock. Supposedly it was supposed to start at 9 o'clock. They actually pulled me out of the holding cell, placed me into the courtroom, and I was there maybe 10 minutes. My attorney was very nervous, very in an uproar. As it turned out, they pulled me out of the courtroom, placed me back in a holding cell for about 3 hours, and the reason for all of this was we had subpoenaed these three people to come back in because we could prove they were lying Monday morning. And the district attorney was telling everybody that the people had left town, that two of them had went to Evanston, Illinois, and one went to God knows where. And as it turned out, we could not get those people back in to a courtroom. All the evidence we had gathered on them over the weekend was allowed to be placed into the trial transcripts, but the jury never heard any of the evidence against these people about their lies. And so that did us no good. At the end of that court day, 2 days later, I was convicted. And shortly after my conviction was posted in the newspapers and on TV, these same three witnesses came out of a Fort Worth motel. All the bills had been paid for by the district attorney's office, so they knew where they were when we were trying to subpoena them, and they were hiding them out because they didn't want them back. We could have proved they were lying.
Yeah, that's actually an amazing story, and I want to come back and discuss the actions of the district attorney's office. But to continue with the details of what happened with you, you were convicted, you were given the death penalty, and sent to death row.
Yes.
In Huntsville, Texas. How did the story proceed? At that point, your attorneys were filing appeals on your behalf.
Yes. In every state that carries the death penalty, you have an automatic appeal. You have no choice, but if you are convicted of a capital case, you must appeal that case. In my own situation, we began to appeal. It went through the state courts. I got no relief. We went into the federal courts and actually got to the Supreme Court and had oral arguments in November of 1979, To back up a little bit, I had a execution date placed on me in May of 1979 and came 72 hours from execution. The Supreme Court stayed that execution. We had oral arguments in November of 1979, and on June 1st of 1980, the United States Supreme Court in Adams versus Texas overturned my case in an 8-1 decision. As the paperwork was filtering back to Texas, to Dallas for retrial, the district attorney, Henry Wade of Dallas, contacted the governor of Texas, Bill Clements, and asked him to commute my case to life to avoid retrial. Of course, we say because we could prove that what the state had done to me. The governor, again, my attorney and I, says illegally, commuted a non-existent sentence to life, and I began to have to appeal a life sentence, and that, of course, is a whole new ball game. I was placed in population at that point, and it ultimately took 9 years. Some of the best legal assistance, that I could get. I was not rich. I just luckily found an attorney that took interest in the case and believed in me and took upon my appeal. It took the interest of a filmmaker to change a documentary he was working on to my case, which ultimately ended up being the Thin Blue Line. It took the mass public, the shock and awareness of what had happened to me from the news media and the film. It took, finally, an honest judge in the Dallas area, Judge Baraka, to allow us evidentiary hearings to get all the evidence in and make a ruling for me. And March 1st of 1989, in Austin, the Texas State Court of Appeals unanimously overturned my case for retrial. And of course, at that time, we had proven my innocence so well, the state just dropped charges and released me.
Okay, so they did drop charges. Yes. Okay. Let's pause briefly for the benefit of any listeners who might be just joining us on the air. I'm Hila Follett. This is Ideas and Issues. And this evening I'm talking to Randall Dale Adams, who was an innocent man who spent 3 years on death row and 13 years in the Huntsville State Prison in Texas. The story you just told us certainly is shocking to me, and I suspect it's shocking to most of the listeners. And in part, I mean, it seems to me there are two things that are shocking. One is the very idea that an innocent man could be convicted of murder and be within 72 hours of losing his life for something he didn't do. What was it like, what was it like just knowing that you were an innocent person who was convicted of a murder, labeled as being a cop killer?
Well, you have to understand that at the beginning of this ordeal, I had just turned 27 years old, honorably discharged from the Army, had never been in trouble. No one in my family had ever needed an attorney, so we were completely ignorant of the legal system. It's a very sad day in a person's life when he and his family is stood up in a courtroom and pretty much looked upon as a leper in society. The hurt and the pain that placed upon my mother and my family, and of course myself. But we are a very strong-knit family. We knew what the truth was. We had our faiths, we had our beliefs, and we knew that at some point, this is a terrible mistake that has to be corrected, that will be corrected. I mean, that sounds naive today. I'm sure there's other people out there who are going through similar situations, maybe not in a criminal sense or something like that. Maybe it's a dreaded disease, but they're sitting back going, you have to have faith. And from the very beginning, my family and I believed that at some point and someday, some judge would listen to us and the truth would be known. And as it turned out, that did happen. Okay. Again, it sounds naive today, but if you lose your faith, if you lose your hope, I could still be in there.
So in a sense, the hope is what made it endurable during that 13 years. the belief that ultimately you get out. Specifically, being on death row and being so close to the scheduled date of execution, was that especially unnerving that last week before the scheduled execution?
Knowing that, first of all, Texas at that point had not executed people, but America was executing again. Gary Gilmore had been executed. John Spinkelink in Florida had been executed. So there had been quite a few executions. Other states were cranking up their death chambers. Texas wanted to get their feet wet, and so it was a very touchy time in the sense that my family and I knew that Texas wanted to execute, would love nothing better than to, quote, execute a cop killer, and vice versa, quote, get rid of the Adams case, because if it ever comes back to us, we got a lot of problems. And so at that point, yes, it was a very scary situation. We knew that the state wanted to execute and wanted to execute me personally.
So you would have been the first person to execute him?
Very easily could have been.
Yeah.
Again, luckily for me, the United States Supreme Court stepped in. We had an argument on our jury selection, and the decision in June 1st of 1980, Adams versus Texas on jury selection, and one case just a few days after mine, another Texas case on the psychiatric testimony, ultimately led to probably a third of death row inmates getting commuted life sentence because of those two decisions.
It's certainly one thing to be wrongly accused, and that alone would be unnerving is the wrong word, frightening beyond belief. But going back to the earlier part of the story, there's a sense in which your case is even worse. It's not that there was an honest mistake made, or perhaps maybe once upon a time it was an honest mistake, but as you've recounted the story, there's considerable evidence that the authorities knew you were innocent, at least at some point. I mean, maybe initially they really thought you were guilty, but fairly soon they realized you were innocent.
Well, it's common knowledge in the Texas system in the Dallas area that once you have been indicted in the Dallas criminal court system, they are going to get convictions. The district attorney that actually argued against me, a man by the name of Douglas Malter, was the number one assistant to Henry Wade. Henry Wade, at this point in 1976, was not trying cases himself. He was just the elected district attorney. Douglas Malter ran the court system for Henry Wade. He had a free hand in what he did and how he did it. Douglas Malter, when he retired from the district attorney's office to go into private practice a few years after my case, had somewhere around 22 death penalties under his belt and God knows how many life sentences under his belt. He retired undefeated, had never lost a case. And, you know, it's a sad day in America when a man can use his position, use his name, his power, his authority to not only manufacture evidence, but to hide evidence, to hide witnesses, to make sure that he does not lose a case. Mr. Malter had he was wanting to be Attorney General, he was wanting to be the next governor, probably dreamed of being in the White House at some point. As of today, he is nothing more than a very high-priced defense attorney. And I have to give the man credit. If I ever needed a very good attorney, I wouldn't go to him, but I would tell some people that he's a very good attorney. But he's not ethical. And sadly, he was in a position that demands ethics. He was in a position as a district attorney. What a lot of people don't understand is when a person accepts a district attorney's job, his job is not convictions. His job is to find the truth and to seek justice. And I don't think this man had a thought about that. All he thought about was convictions.
Okay. Let's turn now to talk in general about the death penalty itself. It strikes me you're in a unique position to talk about the death penalty. I mean, I know from what you've said in the presentation I heard you made yesterday, that you're well aware of the problems of crime and you're well aware that people are afraid of being assaulted or murdered, and you're sympathetic to that. How, though, does your personal experience shape your own views on whether the death penalty should ever be used?
Well, there again, we live in one of the most industrialized nations in the world. As it's written on paper, our legal system is the best the world has ever seen. Sadly, we being humans, we have a tendency to make mistakes now and then. Honest mistakes are honest mistakes. When a mistake is not honest, then it's terrible not only for the system, it's terrible for America. If you could show me a system that's 100% correct, I would say then you would be allowed to have a death penalty. I wouldn't vote for it, but, I would not say that you don't have a right to. With as many flaws, as many potholes, and chances for mistakes that we have in our system today, it is not perfect. It never will be perfect and can't be perfect. To say that a state has the right to execute in the people's name, I have problems with that. I cannot see executing 99 guilty people and then executing one innocent person to get to 99. That's too high a price for me. To the people who listen to me, who I speak to, I have to tell them and ask them to please, before you say I'm pro-death penalty, to ask yourself one question. Would you execute an innocent man? If you can tell me honestly that you would allow an innocent man to be executed, then vote for the death penalty. If you tell yourself that no, you would not want that to happen, then you cannot vote for the death penalty. Because if a state executes, sooner or later, there will be innocent people executed. And that's too high a price.
Well, I take it, in fact, you've done... are familiar with some of the research that's been done on the use of the death penalty and people who've been innocent. Do you know roughly what the figures are? I know that there are a number who were convicted and sent to death row who were later found out to be innocent.
I do know since 1990 there have been at least 22 provable known cases of innocent people being executed. You can say that's not a
1990
very...
or 1900?
Since 1900
to
1990. 22 doesn't sound like a very large number considering all the people we have executed. But that's still 22 very, it's too high, way too high. And sadly, to allow a state to execute in your name makes you just as bad as the people you're executing. It makes you a murderer. It puts blood on your hands. And sadly, the death penalty is nothing but a political tool. Why doesn't, Tennessee has not executed. Ohio has not executed yet. The politicians want to change the law. Every time they have to run for re-election, they have to tamper with the law. When they first made the law in Texas in 1975, 76, it was a good law, but they have to tamper with it every time they need to. And it's a political game is what they play. To me, it's useless. And it costs too much. It costs more to execute than it does to lock a man up. If you must have a death penalty, give them a death penalty. Just don't execute. Let them die in their cell.
Okay. What advice would you give the listeners? Here are people, many of the listeners are going to be afraid of violence. It appears the evidence is going very strong that the fear of violence is very high in our society. How do we proceed as a society concerned about protecting ourselves and not wanting to execute innocent people?
I, of course, have no magic answers for anybody, but you do bring up something that just struck me. for all the listeners out there that are pro-death penalty, please understand, killers are getting younger and younger and younger and younger, and when do we stop? Do we start executing four-year-olds? I mean, some of these people out here are very strange people. So where do we stop this? Let's stop the madness by not killing, period.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not going to stop the crime on the streets. That, sadly, we live in an era that's getting very violent. And, you know, the answer to that, I don't know. I don't know how we got in this position to begin with. When I was a child, we didn't even lock our doors at night. Don't do that now.
Well, what would your advice be to prosecutors and to policemen and judges?
Please understand.
And people who want to beat those guys as well.
Yes. Please understand that I do believe that most prosecutors, most judges, most law enforcement officers, they do the best job they can. They are concerned. They believe in what they do. They want to see justice done. Please understand, I do believe 99.9 of them are that way. I honestly believe most law enforcement are doing the best they can. Sadly, again, we're living in a very violent time. And sadly, it only takes 1%, one person, every now and then to get in a position to misuse and abuse that system. So, you know, I don't say all prosecutors are wrong or judges or police officers. I think most of them are ethical and do the best they can. But as sad as our system is, some people get in there to use it for their own gains. And, you know, again, I don't know. We're living in a very violent age. I haven't understood it. I don't know how we've gotten here, and I don't know how it's going to deter if it doesn't get worse. Hope it doesn't get worse, but I don't see it turning the other way.
Okay. Well, let me just to sort of, we're getting close to time, running out of time. Perhaps give the listeners a sense of what you've done after you were released. You were released, I believe you said, in 1989, so you've been out for 6 years.
Since my release, I of course have to and want to speak out not only about my case but about the legal system. I have had the chance to speak at over 90 colleges. I've had the chance to do numerous death penalty seminars. Was able to get together and write a book about my ordeal, Adams versus Texas. I've had the chance to testify before Senate hearings on the death penalty and the outcome and the, you know, whatever. Again, I have had the chance to do numerous media. I do these things mainly to, you know, to speak to people. I hope that I can, you know, at some point make a change. It may only be one person out of all the people I ever talk to, but if I can help one person in one way, then it's been worth it to me. And sadly, again, it goes back to, you know, I don't think I will ever see in my lifetime the end of death penalties, but, you know, I can hope.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us this evening. I've been talking with Randall Dale Adams, who was in the Texas State Prison for 13 years for a murder he didn't commit and spent 3 years of that time on death row. We've been talking about the death penalty.
God bless.
This has been Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.
Thank you.